Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 186 of Linux in the Ham Shack. And I'm Russ, K5TUX, coming to you from Studio 3D in Southwest Missouri. And across from me is Cheryl.
Hello, everyone.
And we also have, from not quite springtime yet, Big Sky Country, Montana, Bill, NE4RD.
Good evening, everyone.
All right, so let me fade that out and... Let's see. Is it going away? Look at that. It went away. How about that? Cool.
It's a miracle.
Yeah. Stuff works. Oh, no. Okay. So, yeah, we have a show to do. Let's talk about ham radio regulations in the Netherlands.
New Dutch amateur radio regulations highlight the possibility of future restriction in the 23-centimeter band due to the Galileo GPS system, which operates across 1260 to 1300 megahertz. The Netherlands regulator, Agent Shop Telecom, have issued a memorandum concerning unattended amateur radio licenses for repeaters, beacons, and APRS nodes. So it looks like there's some band changes, or at least maybe possibly some power restrictions going to go on there.
So I didn't look at this, but the Galileo GPS system, that's worldwide, I assume, since it's GPS?
I believe so.
But this is only affecting operation in the Netherlands? That seems interesting.
Didn't go on and look deeper in this particular article. I just picked this up this morning, so
I didn't look at it either, so there you go. But we will have a link in the show notes, so if you want to check it out, you're certainly welcome to. Well, I feel like we're doing a bunch of flash topics tonight.
Yeah, it could be that way.
We'll see how it is. Maybe we all just want to get out of here. Who knows?
I thought this article had more information than that. Maybe I was reading a different one. I read a lot of... Oh, no, I was thinking of the Canada article. It was a bit...
Well, we're getting to that. So let's talk about April Fool's Day, which we talked about in the last episode, I believe. And we talked about the AM rally that was coming up. And apparently there's some other stuff going on the weekend of April Fool's Day, including a radar challenge, and radar stands for Rapid Deployment of Amateur Radio. And Portugal is having a national SOTA event that summits on the air in Portugal. And I know there are quite a few mountains out there, so... That should be interesting. So April 1st, and let's see, 1st is the what, Saturday? 1st is a Saturday, so the 2nd Sunday. So should be a pretty busy weekend out there. And
yeah, definitely a lot of activity on the bands.
Okay, so anyway, links to all of those events, the Portugal SOTA event, the Radar Challenge, and the AM Rally that we talked about before, will be in the show notes. So check that out, get on the air, and contact some people. And now, Bill, you can talk about driving while...
Distracted driving in Canada. Yeah. Sorry. It's an update.
He's so sorry.
So sorry. We need some Justin Bieber here. Anyway, in Ontario, a temporary exemption for amateurs in Ontario is due to expire on January 1st, 2018. The RAC Ontario South Director, Phil McBride, VA3QR, and the RAC Northeast Director, Al Boyd, VE3AJB, have obtained some letters of support, but more are needed. They are looking for additional letters of support from organizations that support, that's a lot of supporting, that support amateur radio communications. We need to show our provincial governments the importance of amateur radio and why we require the ability to communicate from our vehicles for public service events like parades, walkathons, bike rallies, and most importantly, for emergency communications and amateur radio emergency service, ARES, activities that support the first responders like police, fire, and EMS. So, you know, this is going around in the news everywhere. We just talked about what Washington State was just talking about, this exact same thing.
Right.
And, you know, this is sort of an important thing as more of these, you know, anti-texting, anti-cell phone laws get placed in state legislatures. It's important that we keep an eye on these things to make sure that there are either, you know, a memorandum of understanding between ARES or the ARRL or, you know, the state section for excluding amateur radio service in this particular area. So I just saw this and I was like, well, we should go ahead and talk about it some more because it is a continued theme that is going through the legislatures in the various states right now. So yeah, definitely. If your state is currently in session, like ours is here in Montana, pay attention to the state bills that are going through the House and Senate, because they can become law real quick.
Yeah, and it's good to keep in mind that it's nice to have the exemptions. There's not a lot of hands-free for amateur radio. That really isn't a thing, at least not that I'm aware of. I don't hear a lot of people talking about doing voice-activated mics and stuff in their vehicles. Pretty much all PTT-type things.
Yeah, generally it's all PTT, but they do have headsets, and you know, some radios do come equipped with Bluetooth and stuff like that. So it's not impossible. It would just turn all your older equipment into obsolete gear. That would be bad, because I don't feel like buying a new.
Yeah, and I don't really either. And some of these laws are actually getting to the point where they're wanting to ban hands-free as well. So I'm not sure how they're going to adjudicate that. Kind of hard.
Well, it's easy for them to do that in the state legislatures and Senate. So that's why it's important that you stop it there.
Right.
So, this is happening in Canada. It's happening around here. We talked about it in Washington. Just pay attention and make sure that your section managers are paying attention as well. If you don't hear back from your section managers on items like this in your state, you should probably think about replacing them next time they come up for re-election.
Yep, you got to have the elected representatives on the pulse of things, especially stuff that kind of matters, and this is one of those things that matters. So moving on from our amateur radio topics, we're going to talk about some open source topics, and the first one we're going to talk about is Samba, or Samba, however you want to pronounce it. It's a dance, and it's also software package that allows you to integrate between Linux and Windows. We had some feedback. It was either last episode or the one before that. We were asked to talk a little bit about specifically SMB client, but I guess we can touch on Samba a little bit. From the Samba website, it's defined as an open source free software suite that provides seamless file and print services to SMB/CIFS clients. Samba is freely available, unlike other CIFS/SMB implementations, and allows for interoperability between Linux and Unix servers and Windows-based clients. And the current version is 4.6. Samba, I think some of the other distributions have Samba as old as 3.something, but they all still work. It's just feature sets that are missing. So Bill put in here, what are we supposed to talk about? Well, I guess we can talk a little bit about what Samba does. It's pretty simple what Samba does. It's a server that runs on a Linux machine that allows, you know, it listens on the same ports that Windows would for doing file sharing, and you can set it up, and it comes pretty much working out of the box. There's some basic configuration you can do to set passwords on things and user permissions and home directory structures and stuff like that. But by default, if you just install Samba and fire it up and then start a Windows client on the same network, and as long as your work group is set the same, you will pretty much be able to access home shares on that Linux machine. I don't think it's available to guests by default. You have to have a username and password, but I think it, as long as your username and password match, it should work fine. I know I usually have to run the SMB password to set up the password. I don't know if that's necessary anymore, but I usually do it anyway. There's just a Linux command called SMB password, SMB PASSWD. It's the same as the password command. It just sets a password. I think it's a B-tree hash or something.
For the server.
Right, for the service itself. And as long as the username and password in that file matches the Windows username and password, you will have access to the share. And of course, you can do all kinds of other crazy things with Samba. Some people are actually using it as an Active Directory drop-in, because it integrates with LDAP for authentication and setting up file permissions and remote home directories and all of that stuff. So if you don't want to pay for Active Directory, you can use Samba. That I haven't gotten very deep into, so I don't know how effective it is, but I know people are using it, so it must be pretty good. I was playing around with a tool called GOSA, G-O-S-A, which is a GUI overlay for configuring Samba authentication and Samba file sharing. Fortunately, I didn't actually get a chance to finish playing with it before the show, so I can't really talk about it, but it's a fairly simple install. That much I did get to. You can just do an apt install GOSA, G-O-S-A, on a Linux Debian machine, Ubuntu, so on and so forth, probably SUSE as well, or if not, you can download the source package and whatever, and it kind of walks you through. You have to have an LDAP server someplace. Doesn't have to be on your local machine. But in a testing environment, I had it on mine. You know, it walks you through setting it up, and then it lets you manage Samba.
And it looks like starting with version 4, Samba can also run as an Active Directory domain control. So,
right. So it can be a PDC or a BDC. Yep.
Yeah.
So if you're into Active Directory and your company's paying for it, you might want to take a look at Samba. Some companies just like to pay for stuff. So, you know, you'll be out of luck there. But I think we had a specific mention from the gentleman who asked us about Samba, because we was in reference to connecting to a Windows 2000 server. I'm pretty sure this was in the last episode, and I've already forgotten who it was. So if somebody wants to go back to the show notes from the last episode and tell me who it was, that'd be great. They wanted us to talk about SMB Client, and SMB Client is basically an FTP client for Samba. So I'm not sure how much there is to say about it, but if you install Samba and the Samba client and the Samba utilities on your Linux machine, you can just run SMB client as if you were doing a CLI-based FTP, and you can connect to a Windows share, or you can connect to another Samba share. So, you know, if you've got a Windows machine out there that's sharing out publicly a directory, you can do SMB client //hostname/share, and then, of course, it'll ask you for your credentials if you need them. And then you have a CLI FTP interface. You can do gets and puts and DIRs and all that kind of stuff. I was trying to get it to actually run on this this Mac here using Homebrew, but I never got that far. So
yeah, so the email was from Gene, BX8AAD.
Yeah, that's who it was.
Yeah, and he needed to do some automated backups of files from a, don't laugh, Windows 2000 file server. But he wanted to do it using Linux. I used to do this all the time. So you can actually create a mount point as well for your SMB share or your Windows 2000 file server, and keep the Linux box actually mounted to the box, and use any kind of backup tool like rsync or whatever if you want to just create a copy, a mirror, or whatever you're trying to do. It's actually quite simple to do. And I believe you can even embed the username and password if you don't really care about it being in your mount tab.
Right.
So it auto mounts and everything else. And I know I did this to back up some instruments and stuff like that in a laboratory environment from a Linux server. So it was mounted to all the individual instruments, and then we just rsync them overnight, and we'd have a snapshot of what was going on in the box. So it is actually quite easy. And Windows 2000, obviously, I think that runs the older version of the protocol, but it should be fine to run it with the latest version of Samba. He didn't mention what kind of server he was actually running, so can't really tell there, but you should probably be able to get, you know, one of the later, greater versions of Samba, and it's probably backwards compatible.
I'm sure it is, and you can also, if I remember correctly, use the -A option to specify an authentication password file, so that you can keep your client passwords in there so you don't actually have to pass them on the command line. And then you can restrict that as necessary to only give you access for the person who's running SMB. You know, that'll kind of tighten that up a little bit. And of course, the man pages and the info pages and even the --help on the command line give you all kinds of helpful information about SMB clients. So it should be very easy to automate a file transfer and backup solution using it. It's pretty powerful. And it's very basic and simple and a very shallow learning curve when it comes to using it for that kind of thing.
Yeah, if he has any more questions or whatever, yeah, just send us our way and we'll research it.
Yep, and if anybody has any questions about additional functionality that Samba might be able to do, just send us an email or, you know, drop us a voicemail and we'll answer any questions we can. There's also the Linux in the Ham Shack Google Plus group, which is a great place to ask questions because there's a bunch of people in there and they usually get through to the answers before I even know there are questions. So it's another way to get answers, especially if you need one in a hurry. There's also IRC too. There's a Samba IRC channel. Always a good place to get information. I get a lot of tech support from IRC. I mean, that's a great place to go.
Yeah, quick responses for
yep,
sure.
Super quick. Well, depending on what channel you're in. Some people, I mean, there's like 2,000 people in the channel and they take their sweet old time about answering, but it's still faster than and cheaper than calling up, you know, the actual support line.
Yeah.
All right, so that's our little treatise on Samba for the evening. So let's talk about open source world. It is an open source world.
Yeah, sure is. So open source world, you know, I normally don't promote other podcasts or whatever, but this one was worth a listen. I listened to the TED Radio Hour podcast episode entitled Open Source World. The era of open source has led to countless innovations. When does it work? When is it in chaos? In this episode, TED speakers explore how open source is changing the world, or changing how we build, collaborate, and govern. The speakers talk about where open source started, the decimation of Gopher. And if anybody can remember that, Gopher, they wanted to actually monetize Gopher at one point, and that's basically what stuck a nail in it and called it dead, and then we got the web. Linux, the philosophy of open source, democracy, and differences in crowdsourcing versus open sourcing. So it's you know, the radio hour is a short program. Obviously, they take a shortened snapshots of several speakers. So if you just want the quick abridged version, just go ahead and check out the show notes or Google you know, over there to NPR and catch that episode. It is quite interesting, and you can listen to the individual speakers in length if you go to the website as well. So yeah, definitely worth a listen.
All right, very good. Always nice to have new resources to offer for folks, because, I mean, obviously we don't have all the information out there. And TED Talks are wonderful things to listen to. I mean, there's a lot of intelligent people out there with a lot of great things to say, and I've never been disappointed listening to someone do a TED Talk. So
No, this was just right up our alley, so it was really good.
All right, very good. So let's move on to a LinkedIn project, which is kind of interesting because I hate LinkedIn. But anyway, tell us about Flashback.
Okay, so this is sort of a flash topic, and surprisingly, it's called Flashback. LinkedIn open sources Flashback, internet traffic mocking tool. Flashback is designed to mock HTTP and HTTPS resources like web services and REST APIs for testing purposes. It records the requests and plays back previously recorded transactions, which is called a scene, so that no external connection to the internet is required in order to complete testing, according to the article from TechCrunch. So it's just another new tool for doing basically mocking traffic on your APIs. So you know, take a look at it. You know, obviously it's being used at LinkedIn for their testing for their service, and they tend to handle quite a few users. So might be an interesting tool to look at and compare to what you're already using if you're a developer of web services.
Oh, so you're testing your own API from the client side. Gotcha. I was thinking it was the other way around. So,
No. Yes. It's like an outside test framework or a mocking framework for, you know, testing what you've already built. You know, this would be something in addition to doing, you know, your normal, you know, test framework inside the application for test-driven development or whatever you want to call it.
All right, cool. So if you're into doing any kind of programming, especially web programming, this might be a great tool to get in touch with. I don't know how many of our listeners are web programmers, but thinking it might be a fairly small subset, but who knows? All right, so moving on, I threw this in here because it's something that I recently found out about. I've been trying to figure out an easier way for me to get my hands on tech news and open source and amateur radio topics without actually having to go out in the world and find them every time we do a program. So I came across this kind of a neat project called Tickr, T-I-C-K-R. And what it does is it aggregates RSS news feeds into a literal ticker. It's a desktop ticker for Linux machines. And what's nice about it is it's very configurable. You can tell it where you want this ticker to be on your screen. You can make it always on top or not. So you can put it at the top, the bottom. You can make it full width, not full width. You can, you know, stick maybe if you have a certain part of your screen, like your top menu bar that's not fully used, you can put it there. You can program colors, transparency, backgrounds, all of that cool stuff. And then you can tell it what web browser you want to integrate. I think it defaults to Firefox, but you can change it to Chrome or Chromium. And then you import into it OPMLs or single XMLs of news, or, well, actually any kind of RSS feed sites. And then it will run a scrolling ticker across your desktop wherever you happen to put it. This worked out super well for me. I keep it at the bottom of my screen. So when I'm running, and it's basically at the same height as my bottom menu bar, but it only exists in the part of it that is, generally speaking, empty. And I keep it always on top so that no matter what's going on my screen, there is a ticker scrolling by on the bottom with news articles. And in my case, I have a bunch of tech sites, things like TechCrunch and the Register's tech blog and ZDNet and CNN and like all of these sites that aggregate tech content. And I have it scrolling on my screen all the time. And as I'm doing stuff, I'll, you know, take a look down there every once in a while. And if I see something that's interesting, I just click on the link and it brings it up in my browser and I can say, oh, this is kind of neat. So this is a great way to have streaming and constantly rotating technology information coming at me where it's always sort of in my view, but not really in my face, so that I can find stuff that's worthy of talking about on the program. For me, that's exactly what I'm doing with it. Now, when I was doing that, I was like, well, I'd like to find a bunch of sites that would be good for me to, you know, have all this information come from without having to actually go find all those websites, because that was what the problem was in the first place. So it turns out Google is my friend. I did a Google search for it, and I found a website, the link to which will be in the show notes. It's from a guy's blog. His name is Philip Smith. And he published this back a while ago, so some of the links don't actually work, and you can update them accordingly as you want, but it's an OPML file download of, I think it was 112 different technology news sites that you can just directly import into Ticker, and boom, you have all of the tech information you ever wanted. That worked out really well for me, and I've been using it for the last few days, and I'm really loving it, and I'm hoping that it will generate some great content for the show, and if nothing else, it'll keep me a little more informed about the world of technology. So
very retro.
Very retro? What, news tickers?
Yeah, I remember seeing these like a long time ago on Linux desktops. Basically, when Windows came out with Active Desktop, you saw a lot of these things kind of pop up in Linux.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I find it, for me personally, the way my brain works, it is probably one of the best ways to get information into my head, because something needs to be there and just sort of presented to me, and then I can say, oh, I'm interested in that, click on it, boom, and away you go. So a news ticker is kind of the way I think.
Well, that's kind of cool. Yeah, I mean, I use Feedly.
Right, I've used Feedly too.
RSS aggregation.
Right.
And then Hacker News for kind of random other stuff.
Right, but things like Feedly actually give you like a page with aggregated news information, which you have to consciously go to. See, if I have to think about it, I'll never do it. So This actually puts the information in front of my face, and I don't have to think about it. I just happen to glance down at the bottom of my screen, and I'll say, oh, look, there's news about, you know, this chip maker in Asia. Oh, that's curious. I'll check that.
It's kind of like reading the newspaper for me. That's what I see Feedly as.
Right.
Just kind of always go to it in the morning. It's like, oh, okay, 60 new things. Let me look through them and look through it on the phone or anything else like that.
No, and I get that. I used
to be a big Google Reader user, so, you know, when that went away, I almost died.
Right, and I get that, but I sort of have so much going on that I never even think about trying to catch up on the news. This just makes it first and foremost without me having to do anything.
Can you, like, bookmark things and stuff like that in it?
Yes, you can.
Sweet.
Yeah, it has all kinds of features that I didn't even touch on, but the help documentation is excellent. The link to the project is in the show notes. The link to the OPML download of all the tech sites I found is there. And, of course, you can add all of the ones you want. You know, you can as long as they provide an RSS feed, you can have a bazillion of them. It doesn't matter. So same thing with Feedly and all the other ways that you can aggregate RSS. I just thought it was neat, and it's, of course, in the Debian repos, and it may be elsewhere as well. You can just apt-install Ticker, and there you go. So we're going to move on to Linux in the Ham Shack, and Bill's been diving into other distributions again. Surprise, surprise.
Well, really just one. I was revisiting the community editions in Manjaro, which, of course, is the easy install for Arch. And I can't remember why I uninstalled it the last time, but I'm sure it had to do something with OBS. So I was searching around for some issue on Deepin. Yeah, I'm still running Deepin here. I came across a link that had discussed the community editions for Manjaro, and that there was a Deepin edition. So with basically a pre-installed live CD with Deepin already on it. So I wanted to check out the integration and how different it was from, you know, the straight Deepin installation, which is still, you know, just sitting on top of Debian anyway. So so I loaded it up on the VirtualBox, gave it a ride. And it worked quite well. After I did the system update, which, you know, if you install any version of Manjaro, it is a it is a rolling release, so you're going to see a zillion updates. Most of the items disappeared from the dock, which I thought was kind of strange. All the stuff was still there, so I just reattached some stuff to the dock just to make sure everything was functional, and it worked well. And I also installed the 4.9 real-time kernel and stuff like that, and everything worked, and you know it operates exactly the same as being on Manjaro. You know, there's no difference. It's just they changed the GUI for the front end, and the integration is quite nice. I mean, it looks spot on for what I have right now, and it is, I think, maybe a version, maybe like 15.3. If you were using deep end versions, it might be just a slight behind the beta that I'm running right now, but yeah, it will look great. So I mean, if you want the deep end feel, you know, there's already kind of a pre-installed look and feel edition of it straight from Manjaro. You have to go into the community editions and download that differently. Now, there was an upgrade to Xorg that required me to use Pac-Man directly, which is, of course, the package manager. So I added that in the show notes as well, because I had to do it on both of the two community editions that I downloaded. It'll definitely get past any error you have with the regular GUI updater. With replacing files and stuff like that, complain in that GUI installer. So I also saw that they had a Budgie version of Manjaro as well. So, you know, me being a big fan of Budgie and Solus, I tried that as well. And this one was a little bit different. When I installed it and I ran the updates, when I rebooted, the first time I rebooted, I got a dialogue that said, you know, do you want to load the current theme, old theme, or cancel? And I noticed that the GDM and stuff like that loaded up just fine behind that error box. So I just said cancel. So that was kind of weird. Then I ran the updates again and I went looking for the kernel manager, which if you use Manjaro, you know, that's it's one of your settings items in the settings manager. But I couldn't find it through settings in this particular Budgie desktop. So if you go into the normal Budgie settings, all the normal stuff for Budgie was there, but there was no icon for the kernel. So I had to run Manjaro settings manager separately in order to access it, in order to throw on the 4.9 kernel. And, when I rebooted that time after the kernel reboot, everything was fine again. So, if you're a fan of Arch distributions and, you're starting from scratch and you want one of these two desktops, definitely the community editions are the way to go. They did run quite nicely, and, like anything Arch, it does run quite zippy. I might consider changing again for it. So I didn't put any links to the actual downloads, but I'll get those into the show notes and we'll go from there. But no change in the LHS scores on those, the readiness scores. I mean, it has the AUR system for packaging, the extra stuff for all the ham radio stuff. And it is all pretty much up to date. I believe the only one that's a little behind is probably CQR log at 2.04. I think you said you just updated it in yours, what, to 2.06?
2.05, I believe, is what was on.
2.05.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it might be a version behind, but I think they also have access. If you want the actual Git version of CQR log, it is there. However, every time someone does a commit, you're going to get a notification for an update. I wouldn't recommend that. So if you're on AUR packages, don't get the Git ones. You know, get the release build, so that way you at least get normal release numbers instead of every time someone changes a comment in the repository, it doesn't require you to recompile and re-upgrade everything in there. So, buyer beware on that. So, I like both of the desktops, and that's really what I look for. That's why I changed desktop so much.
Right, you're like
I always change it based upon looks.
You like the eye candy, just like me.
Yeah, I mean, Linux is Linux, so the undergarments don't really matter too much. You know, it's all the same. You know, somewhat.
Right.
You know, some would argue that you better optimization and so on and so forth. So, but I mean, for the normal user, these would be great if you just wanted that kind of desktop with the Arch background and the access to all the AUR stuff. I mean, it's definitely the way to go.
All right, very good. I might have to check out this Deepin thing and pop up a virtual machine environment and see how it looks. Since I know
it's pretty slick. It already comes installed with the client stuff, so you can resize the window and everything else. It's quite nice.
Pretty interesting. But I'm going to talk about another distribution, one that I mentioned in the last episode and said I didn't get a chance to play with it, but I did get a chance to play with it today. So there we go. I did it in a virtual machine environment under VirtualBox. And what this is Gecko Linux. And I'm just going to read a little bit here from the Gecko Linux website before I talk about it. It's a Linux spin based on the OpenSUSE distribution with a focus on polish and out-of-the-box usability on the desktop. It is available in static, based on Leap, and rolling, based on Tumbleweed, editions. Features include an installable live image around 1 gig in size, individual editions for several popular desktop environments, and I'll let you know what those are in a second, carefully selected open source desktop programs and proprietary media codecs pre-installed and ready to use, stylish open source font rendering configured out of the box, optimal power management with TLP pre-installed, and more. Gecko Linux prefers packages from the Pacman repo when they're available, whereas some of OpenSUSE's default packages don't work with patent-restricted features, even if the features are installed from other sources. Gecko Linux does not force the installation of additional recommended packages after system installation, whereas OpenSUSE pre-installs patterns and automatically installs recommended packages dependencies, thus causing many additional and possibly unwanted packages to be installed the first time the package manager is used. Gecko Linux's desktop programs can be uninstalled with all of their dependencies, whereas OpenSUSE's patterns often cause uninstalled packages to be automatically reinstalled. So that was a few things that came directly from the Gecko Linux website. It did mention the fact that it comes pre-configured with a bunch of different desktop environments, and there are lots of them. Cinnamon, XFCE, GNOME, KDE Plasma, Mate, Budgie, LXQt, and one without a desktop environment at all. And all of those are available as a download via the Tumbleweed rolling release or Leap as a static release. I chose the Budgie version just because I'm kind of hip to Budgie right now. So, Budgie. Yeah, Budgie. So that's the one I picked. I picked the Tumbleweed version of Budgie, installed it in a virtual machine environment, and then installed a bunch of ham radio packages to see how they worked in the ham radio world. Now, the first thing I noticed was that in the same way that OpenSUSE does things, you have to add additional repos if you want to get ham radio software. I installed like all of the community repos, which you can do with a single click, but in order to install the ham radio repos, you have to know what the URL of the ham radio repos is. And to me, that's not intuitive, so I kind of dinged OpenSUSE for that, which is why my LHS readiness score may not be as high as some of the other distros we've talked about. However, it's very good looking desktop, as we all know Budgie is. Customization when it came to desktop look out of the box, but that's not really that big a deal. You can always download themes and desktops and all that kind of thing, so not a big deal. But it does look very nice out of the box. You can't really tell that it's OpenSUSE underneath, because when you're running Budgie, it's just really flashy and has, you know, the dock lit and all of that kind of cool stuff. And the installation procedure was very nice. You run it in the live environment, and then you choose the installer, which is on the desktop. I don't think there were more than 6 or 8 clicks involved, all of which were very intuitive, and you had a perfectly running system. You reboot and all is well. Once I got the ham radio repos installed in there, I installed some basic stuff. I installed Chirp, I installed FLDigi, WSJTX, CQRLog, and I think there were 1 or 2 other ones that I tried. Now, this, I did notice that MariaDB was not installed with CQRLog, so that is apparently a bug in this. I doubt they'd call it a bug, but the fact that a dependency is missing is a bug to me. And it was the latest version, 2.05, although my version of Chirp that came with the system was from back in December, and it immediately complained about the fact that there was an update when I started it. So not everything is completely up to date, but it's all functional. Of course, HamLib was installed by default. With the first ham radio application I installed, everything worked straight out of the box. WSJTX looked great. FLDigi worked perfect. CQRLog worked fine once you installed MariaDB. Chirp, of course, worked fine. So, and of course, once you had repos installed, then using YAST2 to search and install applications was super easy. So, overall, I thought it was very easy to use. And considering it's not a Debian-based distribution, I give it some pretty high marks, and I find myself very comfortable with Debian and don't like getting out of my comfort zone very much, but I could find myself using Gecko Linux very easily. So based on all of that, I'm going to give a LHS readiness score of 4.0.
Well, I just looked back on episode 176, and we gave Tumbleweed 4.5, Where did the extra half a point go?
Who was reviewing Tumbleweed, though? You or me?
It was me.
Yeah, there we go. So
I was a bit more generous, I guess.
I guess so. You might be a little more comfortable with RPM-based distros as well. So,
and, you know, 10 episodes ago, we had exactly the same problem. So that's been around for a little while.
So maybe one of these days they'll get around to fixing that. Maybe we need to talk to the maintainer. One thing I did want to touch on, that was the thing I just put in the show notes, is that there was last episode or the episode before, I was talking about Brian Lunduke's thing about some of the things he thought Linux should have. And one of those things that he mentioned was variable sized icons, which means you can resize any icon to any size, not just your entire desktop. When I was playing around today with, and the thing of it is, I can't remember if it was on my Debian box or if it was on the OpenSUSE box, but one of them allowed me to right click on icons and then change that individual icon to any size I wanted, independent of any of the other icons on the desktop. So that feature is in Linux. It's already there. It does exist. So there you go.
Cool. Yeah, I normally don't run any icons on my desktop. The only one that gets cluttered like that is my Windows boxes.
Yeah, I actually use fences on my Windows box to keep my icons organized.
Well, la-ti-da.
Yeah, so maybe if we ever talk about Windows stuff, we can talk about fences. But that's neither open source nor free. So we don't talk about stuff like that. But, you know, if you have to use Windows, you might as well use something that makes Windows palatable. So, and that's all I've got in the way of topics for our first three segments. Unless anyone in the chat room wants to speak up and say anything about anything, we have some music to play. And no one's talking about anything in the chat room, so we're just going to move on to the music. And this week, I picked a song by a French group called The Green Duck. And they do Irish, Celtic, and folk music for whatever reason, even though they're French. This one came out in November of 2016. It runs a little over 4 minutes long, and it's a song called Blow It Away. And I don't know, I've been in kind of a Celtic folky mood lately, so I thought this one was pretty good. So we'll play it here, and then we'll get back to talking about stuff.
Tonight we gonna drive a long, long time. I got a girl, and tonight we gonna leave it all behind. All the wasted time is gone. We are not young anymore. You know what we're waiting for. and just wait for life to come. Biden will be dead and gone. From this moment we are born. We are born.
That was The Green Duck with Blow It Away, and Bill in the chat room is talking about the fact that it sounds like Little Lion Man, and it kind of does. And they actually cite them as one of their influences. Groups,
yeah,
like
no kidding.
So
I was like, what song am I listening to here?
But to say that it sounds like the song of a big name act is probably a compliment.
Yeah, well, you know, Robin Thicke would have a problem with that.
Okay. But anyway, November 2016, The Green Duck, Blow It Away, group out of France. And I actually thought that was pretty good, even though if it does sound like other people.
Yeah. I mean, it sounded great, but it's like, wow, that sounds very familiar. Maybe too familiar.
You listen to a lot of Irish music, it all starts to sound kind of familiar. So anyway, I hope everyone enjoyed that one. A link to the track, of course, will be in the show notes. And you can always look up The Green Duck. They have a Facebook page and a website and all kinds of stuff. So there you go. And they play lots of shows, just not any in the United States. So moving on to announcements and feedback. We basically just have some festuses to talk about.
Festivus.
Festivus. Yeah, that's not till December, though.
Festivities.
Festivus, sure, for the rest of us.
Exactly. I figured I would throw this out there. RARS Fest, which is in Raleigh, North Carolina, is coming up in April, mid-April, which is very soon now. We had an ambassador for that last year, but my attempts to contact said ambassador for this year have fallen on deaf ears, apparently. So if you happen to be in the Raleigh, North Carolina area or somewhere around there and you want to be an ambassador for Linux in the Ham Shack for RARS Fest, please get in touch with me like real soon, and we'll set you up so that you can do that. That'd be a lot of fun for you, hopefully, and get the word out for us. That'd be great. And we're also looking for an ambassador for the Southeast Linux Fest. That comes up in June, and that is also in North Carolina. Actually, it used to be in South Carolina. Yeah, now it's in North Carolina. So, I guess we just need to spread the word all through the Carolinas. But yeah, if you can do either one of those, that would be great. I mean, we get the booth. We've already been offered a booth at Southeast Linux Fest. We just don't have anyone to man it. You get some free swag if you do the thing, and you get to promote Linux in the Ham Shack, and it doesn't really cost you anything except a little bit of your time. So,
and it keeps us from having to drive 14 hours.
14 hours out to South Carolina or North Carolina. Yeah. Links to the RARS Fest, Southeast Linux Fest, of course, will be in the show notes. And then, of course, there's Hamvention 2017 coming up in the middle of May. We're all going to be there. We're pretty much set up. We finally have our booth reservation. We will be in booth 5007. That's 5007, which is in building 5. We'll be right next door to Tom Medlin, W5KUB. So that'll be nice. We'll be a couple of rows away from Heil. And it should be a good spot for us. So come check us out, booth 5007. Of course, that stuff's out on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else, because I'm also promoting our 2017 Hamvention Generosity campaign. Right. So that's actually doing really well, considering we're still 7 weeks out from Hamvention.
And only 10 days into it? 9 days?
No, we're like 16 days in, I think. But we're over 25% funded right now. And that's very good. Unfortunately, our booth rent went up this year, so we definitely need whatever help we can get to pay for the booth. We did get a little bit of a break from the Hamvention guys, but a normal booth costs $600. And we're not paying $600, but we're paying a significant chunk of that. So we definitely need some help. that's a lot of money to, you know, for a project that doesn't actually make any money, that's a lot of money to just kind of throw out there. Right. So if you can
help. We also take bottles of scotch on the, when we're there on the tape. Just want to drop that on by.
Right.
That little bucket, we're fine. Just fine with it. We'll accept that as cash.
So anyway, the generosity campaign is going. Please donate if you can. Even if you can't, please share it everywhere. Share it on every social media network. Share it at your local club, wherever you can share it. Even $5 will help out. Like I said, we're doing pretty well, you know, considering we still have a ways to go. We appreciate everybody who's donated so far, but just keep sharing it. I'm trying not to make a nuisance of myself. I'm only posting every 4 days or so, just so everyone's not inundated with it. But we do need the funding to get out there, because it's not a cheap endeavor. So,
you know, I said this on Facebook. Maybe I should promise that I will take my test and pass it, because I'll just keep taking it.
Well,
if people will donate, I don't have a whole lot of time between now and Saturday to study,
right.
Since I've not really cracked open any books or anything to read about anything. So
right. I would just go through, if you can do the practice test and if you can hit those at 80% or better, you're going to pass your test.
All right, cool.
So I would just keep doing that and then review your missed answers, memorize which one it was, and just keep,
right, keep going from there.
Yeah, I would not screw around with reading the book and anything else like that. It's such a waste of time.
You know, funny, I figured that out when I took the ACT in high school. I spent months like drooling over that book and then got in there and went, you've got to be joking.
Well, guess what? Part of this podcast is getting cut out.
That?
Yeah, sorry. I know. It's all a scam.
It's all right.
No, very easy. I think it's much easier now than it was when I took my technician, and probably Russ took his technician back in the 90s.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you guys
had questions. It was like 75 questions or something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to do Morse code stuff too, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, if you wanted the Tech Plus at the time,
right?
And they do have a choice. The VEs have a choice of the tests that they put together. It's like that, and it's been my experience that they try not to put too many of mathematical questions. Generally, you'll only get like one question on diagramming. So, you know, you figure you can weigh your odds, not have to worry too much about that.
Right. Alrighty then.
All right. Well, you can put that out there if you want to. We'll see if it works.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. Because then we get the three sessions on Hex Chat running. And then we all three have a chance to get prizes from Tom. And he doesn't have to go that far to give it to us.
That's right. That's right.
And Tom, just hand that over.
Yeah, hand it over the little curtain there, you know.
All right. That's our Hamvention news, and we're going to move on to Cheryl's Recipe Corner.
Yay. Yeah, I was madly typing this at the beginning of the podcast. So anyway, the recipe that I picked this week is for muffin tin omelets. They're a perfect thing if you're running short on time in the mornings, but you want something warm to eat. I used to make these for us all the time. Russ would have them on his way out the door because it's something you can pop in the microwave for a minute or so and go right out the door with it. And they look like a blueberry muffin or whatever, but it's actually eggs and meat and vegetables and stuff. So for the muffin tin omelets, you need 8 to 12 eggs, some milk or heavy cream, shredded cheese, chopped meat like a deli ham, Canadian bacon, sausage bacon, you know, whatever you want. Make sure these items are cooked if they're not already pre-cooked. Some chopped vegetables, onion, green pepper, green onions, mushrooms, whatever you want. Again, might want to saute these so they're not crunchy omelet, unless you like them that way. Some salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper.
Yeah, salt and pepper. Salt and pepper or any other spices and herbs that you prefer to taste. And you throw the eggs and the milk in a bowl, mix it up, add the cheese and veggies and stuff to it, and then dollop it into little muffin tins. And you can either use little paper cups or you can just, you know, grease your muffin tins. And bake them at 350 for about 20 minutes, and then stick them in a Ziploc bag in the fridge. And after you're, you know, in the mornings when you're running short on time, pop a couple in the microwave and, you know, microwave them for about a minute, and you've got breakfast. And I think Russ used to like these.
I love them. Okay. I love anything you can just kind of pop in the microwave for 30 seconds and have a breakfast. I mean, that's my kind of breakfast. So
yeah. Except you hate breakfast, so you usually eat it for lunch. So
I hate breakfast if I don't have the right stuff for breakfast. But you know, these egg McMuffin things. They're not really McMuffins, but they're egg muffins. They're kind of like little quiches almost.
Yeah, basically little mini quiches. So
yeah, those are fantastic. Love them. So
yeah, all right. Country fried steak and eggs is too.
Well, that is true. But that's a hell of a lot of work.
That'll get me out of bread for breakfast.
I do country fried steak for dinner with, you know, mashed potatoes and gravy, and you know, Russ apparently is quite fond of that. I don't make it very often because it is kind of a pain in the butt to make, but so
yep. Yeah, I'm kind of like, if I ever see that on the menu somewhere, I just have to order it. Yeehaw!
Yeehaw! And Russ is over there sniffing his scotch, so I guess I should let him get on with his.
Well, we have a new segment number here, I see.
Yeah, apparently so.
Yep.
He's so special. He's
trying to phase me out. It's okay.
No, so. I'm not trying to phase you out. I'm just phasing me in. That's all.
So. You get to do the rest of the podcast.
Let's see if I can railroad his whiskey corner here.
So as of episode number 186, I've written myself in a new segment, which has kind of been unofficial up until now. But in response to Cheryl's recipe corner, I've now added Russ's whiskey corner. Because I didn't want to be specific to scotches, because I like to talk about bourbons and ryes and other things as well. I've just been focusing on scotch. So for this week, I actually do have another scotch. I just pulled one off my counter in there to, because I'm pretty sure I haven't talked about this one. At least I hope I haven't. What this is a Highland scotch, and its name is Glengarryock. At least as close as I can get to, I think, of how it's actually pronounced. It's a 12-year... And it's bottled at a fairly high proof for a Highland Scotch. It's 96 proof, which is 48% ABV. And you can definitely tell that on the nose. It is definitely the standard caramel color for a Scotch. This one seems particularly thin. It's not an oily Scotch. It doesn't have much in the way of legs on it, which is kind of interesting. It's not as viscous as I've seen a lot of Scotches, and that might just be the high alcohol content that is keeping that down. Let's nose it here. What?
That's not
bad. What you do? You stick your nose in the glass.
Yeah, I know.
So what I get out of it is I get a lot of the maturation from the casks. I can definitely pick out the oak, and I can definitely pick out the sherry. And other than that, it smells like, kind of like mulled wine. Like, it's just fruit, basically, like, dried fruit. Yeah, that's pretty much it. It's basically oak, sherry, and dried fruit. So let's try it. Well, interestingly enough, it tastes exactly the same. It tastes like oak and sherry and dried fruit. So not terribly complex, but what's interesting is even though that it's 96 proof, it doesn't drink like it is. It's very palatable, and it's not crazy on the alcohol. There's almost like a little bit of leather in it, like way in the background, maybe a little leather, which is actually kind of interesting. I'm not a big fan of Highland Scotches, but this one's pretty good. Even though it's not terribly complex, either nose-wise or taste-wise, what flavors are present there are basically derived from the aging process. So that really works for me. And there's no peat to speak of at all. I don't get peat at all. It actually drinks more like a bourbon than a scotch, but I actually like it. And now I've decided I'm going to use the 100-point scale that most people who review liquor use. Since I've only tasted it the one time, and I'm kind of doing this off the cuff, I'm going to give this, based on my one drink here tonight, an 88, because it's certainly not the best thing I've ever had, but it's far from the worst. So I think an 88 is a good measure for that. I might revise this later on in a future episode, but we'll start there. So Glengarryock 12-year, 48% ABV, Highland Scotch, matured in oak and sherry casks, nose and taste of dried fruit, sherry, oak, a little bit of extra taste in leather, and a rating of 88 out of 100. If you're listening to my recommendations, I would give it a try. And I've seen it anywhere from, I forgot to put price in my list of things to talk about. I've seen it anywhere from $50 to around $80 a bottle. So you have to, I don't know, find the best place to get it. So
we bought that at Thanksgiving, and I think I paid $60.
So. Yeah, so right in the middle of the range. So somewhere between $50 and $80, you can probably find it. So if you want to try it, Glengarryock 12-year. And that's it for my whiskey corner. All right, so guess what? we're down to the social media roundup, and I ran this list through a randomizing algorithm, so they're not in the same order this time.
Dammit. So now I'm going to have to work on my pronunciation, you know, catch myself if I screw up. So.
All right.
Especially when you start off with John.
Yeah.
Damn it. Why'd you put that one first?
I didn't put that first. You can blame randomize.org.
Yeah, well, okay, whatever. Except there's two bills together.
Hey, that's random. So
kinda, there you go. I guess. So.
There you go.
Okay. So for subscriptions, we have John Fotchke, Bob Yerke, James Blocker, Robert Pitts, Dylan Engel, Stephen Sainer, Edward Donnelly, Scott Pettigrew, John Clark, Paul Griffith, Michael Connolly, Donald Gover, Kevin Murray, Alan Wilson, Brian Smith, Ronald Icke, Robert Doherty, Christopher Weaver, Jonas Rulo, Michael Aiello, Darren King, Jeremy Hall, Robert Halliday, Wayne Carpenter, Doug Rutter, Johnny Kinsey, Bill Stearns, Bill Piotr, and Charlie Brown, which is new this week. For Facebook, we have Jeff Miller, Matt McBlair, Alberto Mao, Louis Oscar Rivera, Henning Johansson, and Ravy Heen. On Twitter, we have R. Fraley 79, Circuit Crush, BCR Livestream, and IBM Cloud CA. On Google Plus, we have Jim Titzler and Jason Marinaro.
Jason Marinaro is a name that we've had on here before, but now he's on Google Plus, not a subscriber.
So. Right. And no one on YouTube, no one on the mailing list, and no merchandise sales.
All right. That means we're down to the end. So we will check out the chat room real quick before we run off. I'm not seeing anything going on in the chat room, which means we are kind of down to the end here. Oh, I guess I can look and see who's in the chat room. Well, we have, for people who are awake in the chat room, we have Ted, W-A-0-E-I-R. And we have Jonas Rulo, who's in there. And I believe we still have Jim, 7J1AJH. Earlier, we had Symbola, and we had Don, KB2YSI, and we also had KE5WMA, but they all had to go away early. So, but they were all in here. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we're done, which means I pushed a little button here, and then we hear some music. Yay! So you can become an LHS ambassador. Visit the website for upcoming events and information on how you can represent Linux in the Ham Shack at a nearby LinuxCon or HamFest, and we talked about a few of those earlier in the show. We love feedback, and we haven't got a lot of it lately, so please send us some. You can email us at info@lhspodcast.info. You can comment on an episode on the website, post on Google+, Facebook, or Twitter, or leave a voicemail at 1-909-LHS-SHOW. That's 1-909-547-7469. Visit our IRC channel, Octothorpe LHS Podcast, on Freenode and subscribe to our mailing list. Show merchandise from coffee mugs to t-shirts to wall clocks and everything else can be purchased at www.cafepress.com/LHS Podcast. You can also help the show by clicking on the sponsored ads in the right-hand column of the homepage. And please give to our generosity campaign. We really need the help. Listen live every other Monday night, 8 o'clock Central Time. That's Tuesday at 0100 Zulu now in the summer. And it's 0200 Zulu when we get back to winter time again. Our recording schedule and countdown timer to the next episode are on the website. Please check out http://lhspodcast.info for everything you ever want to know about the show. Thank you to all of our listeners, live and quasi-live, past, present, and future, and all of the people who have given their time, their shares, and their money to the podcast. We appreciate each and every one of you. Thanks again for listening to episode number 186 of Linux in the Ham Shack. I'm Russ, K5TUX. That's Cheryl.
Sorry, reading Facebook.
Say goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.
And from not quite spring in Big Sky Country, Montana, Bill, NE4RD.
73, everyone.
All right, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care. Good night.
Tickle-licious.